Okay, welcome all again to the December meeting of the Ottawa PC User Group. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. I hope you find the information useful. We do have memberships available if you wanted to join the group if you're just coming as a guest, but you can join as often as you want as a guest, so you don't have to join the group in order to benefit from the information that we have available. As you heard, the recording has started, so we are doing audio recording, and that, along with the deck, will go up, and the contents of the chat window will go up onto our website at some point over the next couple of days. So tonight's speaker is Tom Trottier. He's a member of the group, and he's going to be talking to us all about the benefits of layers of security. And so with that, Tom, I will mute all, and you will have to unmute yourself. And with that, I will turn it over to you. So, Tom, take it away.
Okay, I'm having difficulty getting back to slide one of this thing here. I'm not that used to PowerPoint.
Hit the number one and enter.
A horrible introduction.
If you hit one and enter, it'll bring you back to the start.
I think I may have gotten it. Let's see. Okay, slideshow from beginning. And share screen. And that's the one I want to share, I guess. Everybody see a cake?
It is looking good.
Security layers. Security isn't just one thing. It's a whole bunch of things. There are layers and layers because computers are layers and layers of things. And to actually manage security, you need to do a bunch of things. So I'm going to go into why and what and how. So what can you lose? You can lose your identity. Online or in real life, people can apply for driver's licenses and so on, create credit cards, and it's a mess trying to get out. Privacy, you can lose information about yourself, things you don't want to get out, things you want to keep private, as well as data. You can definitely lose dollars. You can lose functionality of your computer. You can lose the ability to communicate. And of course, you can lose your own time. In terms of privacy and data, what can you lose? Documents, photographs, video, email, chat. You can lose programs that you're used to using and maybe you can't find anymore. And what are the threats? Your hard work could malfunction. Fire, flood, theft. These may not seem like security threats for computers, but they're a major source of problems. And internet thieves and vandals, which is more what I'm going to get into. Now, state actors can attack journalists and protesters, and for that you need extreme security, and I'm not getting into that. So there is an action matrix I have here with the threat and the action and what applies to what and all the things that you can do to help protect yourself. So you want to take different actions to avoid or mitigate damages. A basic one is to encrypt your data and communications. Backing it up, authenticating yourself in preferably several ways, preventing problems in your setup, and detecting problems and correcting them. For encryption, You can set a password in your BIOS for your disk in many cases. This is not true of all hard disks or SSDs. You can also do that in software using VeraCrypt, which runs on Win, Mac, and Linux. And for Windows, there are choices other than VeraCrypt. Device encryption, which comes with a lot of computers. It comes with my Asus T100, which I got with Windows 8. It requires a Microsoft account and support in the PC. But it also, since it has an MS account, you can recover the encryption key from Microsoft. You can also use BitLocker if you're using Windows Pro, which is more controllable and more local. Your communications need to be encrypted, and they are not, this guarantees communication from you to the other person and back without interception. Hypertext Transfer Protocol, secure, that's the HTTPS you see in your URL, and Secure Fire Transfer Protocol, or if you're using that to transfer files up and down. Those provide security of the communications, but it doesn't provide security of who you're talking to on the other end. So it does not guarantee that who you think you're talking to is actually who you're talking to. You need to take other steps to secure that. Secure Fire Transfer Protocol, here's an example in Mozilla. You actually choose the protocol here, and you put in a password here, and that allows you to connect securely to the file transfer site on the other end. Encrypting files, you can encrypt files each of them if you want. You can put it in an archive. You can put one file in an archive, or you can put 1,000. And the way you do that there is by entering a password here. And you re-enter it so you won't forget it. And AES 256 is pretty secure. It should be good at least until quantum computers really take off. Backup. One thing people don't think of is their programs. Can you reinstall a program? Can you reinstall the version you're used to? And so it's a good idea to keep CDs, DVDs, ZIPs, MSIs, EXEs of previous programs, previous versions. And if when you download them, they say winpatrol.exe or winpatrol.msi, then you want to change the file name to put in the version number so you know which version it is when you download the next one. You'd like to have hardware backed up as well, having extra or old cables, disks, routers, in case something breaks and you don't want to wait for Amazon or the original person you bought it from to get one. And you want to have backup for your PC account. I run with three accounts. I have my main account, Tom. I have an install account, and I have a recover account. And the install and recover accounts are admin accounts. And I have the recover just in case admin breaks for some reason. Data and programs, you can back them up in the cloud, for example, using Backblaze, Google, Dropbox, OneDrive. You can also use local attached storage. You can use network attached storage, which is available to all your devices on the network, your phone, your TV. Or you can do USB attached storage. And that's version three and onwards are faster than gigabit network attached storage. And you may avoid ransomware by attaching only when you're backing up. As for backup software, Windows has file history, which backs up as continuously as you want, like every 10 minutes. It will keep versions on your backup drive. And you can also back up your system disk. This is in the control panel, and it's backup and restore files. You can create a system image on a hard disk or on a USB drive or a DVD or a network location for that matter. Authentication, who are you? This is usually done by the means of passwords. On your PC or your disk, you can set in the BIOS. You can set a BIOS. You can set a BIOS password for your PC so no one can turn it on without that password. You can also set if your disk supports it, you can set a password for the disk that will encrypt the whole disk no matter what's on it, and you'll have to enter it in before you can start Windows. In Windows, there are rainbow tables disks that allow you to discover passwords of Windows systems. And if you're basically, if you have more than 21 characters, you're probably guaranteed not to have your password discovered by someone who has physical access to your program, to your PC, to be able to run the password tables on it. You can also, for passwords, it's a good idea to have a password manager. One advantage is that now you only have to remember one password, and you can have all your other passwords for programs or for websites to be long, complicated, and arbitrary passwords. And you only have to remember one password and have access to all of them, and yet the password on each site is secure. LastPass is a program to do this, 1Pass, and KeyPass, which is an open source password. There is also a good idea, it's a good idea to have multi-factor authentication. This is a way of having several things that will authenticate you to a website or to your computer. For example, having both a TIN number and a fingerprint on your phone. So it's something that you have, for example, a FIDO2 key, something you know, like a password, passphrase, PIN, something you are, like the fingerprint, face, your retina, your voice, your iris. All of these are pretty much unique to you. Something you can do, like, for example, recognize Amazon obfuscated characters, which prove you're a human and recapture images. Something that fits you, like your location by means of connection or GPS, what network you're on, what software, where you're running. So how can you prevent problems? Well, one of the most obvious ways is avoid telling the world you're on vacation on Facebook. That's is a invitation to any crooks who are on Facebook and say, maybe I'll burglarize them. It's a good idea to have a fire extinguisher for Class C electrical fires. And look up this webpage. Electrical fires, if you have a regular fire extinguisher, it often puts a whole bunch of crap all over what you sprayed, and some of them don't put a bunch of crap over what you sprayed. So it's a good idea to look up what fire extinguisher is good for your computer and for that and anything else that's hard to clean. It's a good idea to have careful power and wire management so you don't overload fuses, you don't have wires running in inflammable areas where heat might start a fire. It's a good idea to have surge suppressors to manage lightning surges that cause excess voltage on your lines. For floods, then plans, adding sandbags, whatever. Use a standard account ordinarily. Use an administrator account for install, so this means you have to enter your administrator password every time you do an install. It's a good idea to have virus and piracy filters and a firewall. It's a good idea to have a UPS. This allows the PC and the network attached storage to shut down gracefully rather than dying suddenly and leaving files in a state where some things are going to be damaged. It's also a good way, a good thing to be aware of your network, what's on it, and of new things that come on it. For UPS, gives 10 to 15 minutes for a graceful PC NAS shutdown. If you have problems, you're out in the boonies, that might be a good idea to have a generator if power failures are common and you really want to have power for your computer or, for that matter, yourself. Data centers, as a point of interest, are usually put on the boundary of two power grids, and they're tied to both to avoid shutting down if one fails. Windows Firewall Control is a way of controlling the Windows firewall. It alerts about new accesses to the internet, or for that matter, to the rest of your network. And you can create, delete, and edit firewall rules. This is what log looks like. This is a connections log. And this is what an alert looks like. Outgoing connection block, Wi-Fi guard, wants to access, the source is me, which is that IP, that wants to look at another thing on the network at 161, using port 161. This is the port number. UDP, and you can, with Windows Firewall Control, you can customize the rule before creating it by removing some of the restrictions here, or making other changes to it. You can block it, or you can allow it, or you can block now and ask later. If you, and it's not just the internet. It's actually, this is my local network, so it's not just the internet that this applies to. And it's a very useful tool for looking at your connections log and for adjusting your firewall rules. You can also, you also should have some kind of virus or privacy filter. So, the Windows security is very good and is recommended by most security researchers that don't work for a security firm. Windows Firewall is good, but you can also get browser add-ons like uMatrix, uBlock Origin, and Privacy Badger that help keep your browsing secure. And let's see. This is one of these add-ons is uMatrix, and it's an add-on extension for most browsers, and it allows you detailed control of what kind of stuff your browser will access. You can click on the line and turn on a whole line, so you can turn on a whole set of domain to be able to access. Be able to be a source for information on your web page. You can turn off individual boxes here. You can turn off scripts or path effects or any of these things. So usually CSS, the green indicates that it's allowed. Pink indicates that it's currently disallowed and it's it doesn't have any special knowledge that these are bad. And the red, this is recent. I don't know what these blacklisted host names are. It used to actually show them, but I haven't seen them. And it blocks everything. These are scripts, and they may come from ads. They may come from other places. And so anything in the pink is blocked. But you can turn them on in individual boxes or for particular domains. You can turn them on. uBlock Origin is made by the same guy, and it's an add-on extension. You can click boxes and lines. You can also over here and restrict all scripts, all fonts, and I forget what those other things are for.
Tom, just as you're going through these extensions, we did have a question whether they're free. So as you go through them, if you could comment on whether they're free or per charge items, that'd be great.
All of the things I've mentioned so far, I think except for OnePass and LastPass, are free. Windows Firewall Control is provided free by Malwarebytes, and they bought it from Binisoft, so that's the URL for it. But all the other ones are free. The add-ons are generally free, or they're donation, or they do often have a link to give them donations. And again, like U-Matrix, you can turn on or turn off these things. The left column is for the current page you're on, or the current domain you're on. And the right column is in general. So you can turn them on for particular sources. So you can turn this on, Akamai Edge, you can turn that on for everyone. The plus indicates that it is turned on already, that the default is on. Third-party frames are by default off. You can turn it off or on directly here. I think if you turn off scripts, then that would show up as being red. Red or pink is blocked. And in uBlock, a darker gray is where you've actually turned them on for particular domains or particular things that you want to control. Privacy Badger. It shows up as a notification like this. This is the top of my browser. And it shows one potential tracker blocked. But it says here there are three. You see it up here. There are three cookies actually blocked, but they all come from the same source, which is something associates-amazon.com. And you can control it for the site. You can report a broken site. Then you can donate to EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a U.S. group that helps to protect access to the Internet for all. And the options are here, show counter trackers, and so on. And there are other controls as well for privacy badges that you can install. And like I said, these are layers. Some of these overlap with, for example, U-Matrix, because you can control cookies here. So Privacy Badger basically controls cookies. I think it may control other trackers as well, but I know for sure it controls cookies. Detection. How do you detect if something is bad, something is wrong in your system already, or something wants to infect your system? One thing you can do is sign up your ID and or domain if you own it at haveibeenpwned.com, and then you'll get an alert by email saying if your email has been found in some data breach. And apparently he's up over a billion emails now that have been revealed in alerts in different data breaches, and some of them have associated data with them that you want to protect, and therefore you should change your password. It might have your SIN number, it might have your name, address, phone number, it might have financial information. It's a good idea to check your ID here and then sign up for the alerts as well. You can also do virus scans. Windows has the Windows Security has an online virus scan, and it's recommended by most security, by a lot of security analysts. But you can also put in other ones from malware bytes and so on, if you prefer. You also need to have phishing and pop-up awareness. This is something that emails and emails and other things may appear normal. They may come to, they may appear to come from a friend. You may have a link and the return email address is a friend, but it's not. because those things can all be faked. And the same thing for a pop-up. If you get something that you're concerned about, then actually talk to the friend. Don't just go clicking random links and emails and pop-ups. One thing you can do to help identify these in email, at least, is to run a program called Popfile if you run your own email program on your computer and keep your email there. Virus scans. There are several kinds of virus scans. You can have a bootable offline virus scans. They are available. This is a link to a lot of them, 10 of them, in fact. They can be safer. You download them on another computer that you're pretty sure of, and it will work with dead systems, not just with the system you cannot boot. So if you can't boot it, maybe the problem is a virus, and this may help you get rid of it. And what you do is you download these and put them on a USB stick or a CD. They usually fit on a CD. They're not that big. And you run that against your computer. You boot up with that USB or CD. So that's something you can do once in a while or if you have a big problem. So phishing, pop-up awareness. They often look like friends links. They could look like a delivery. I seem to get an email from DHL about every week saying, I have a delivery, and from other people. They can look like an invoice or an invitation to a partner or something like that. You can also get them from what appears to be your email host. If you have your own domain like I have with abacurio.com, it may appear that you're getting an email from my host provider, which is 1&1.com, and it's or Ionos, and it is not. and bank notices. Often you'll get them, they'll come from random bank, but maybe they'll appear to come from your bank. Don't click on any of those things in there. Use your room link or Google links to correct the site, to get to the correct site. Popfile is a way to classify your mail. I classify it in, 30 different buckets. And two of those are I alert with. And one of them is fraud. Do you want a partner? Do you want to actually take in things and take in things like money and mail and send them off to somebody else and you take a cut? But some of them are viruses, and it acts as a proxy when you get mail, and it uses Bayesian logic to classify the mail. So it works with things like Outlook, Thunderbird, and Pegasus Mail. I use it with Pegasus Mail. And this is what it looks like. These are all the buckets I have with all the interests I have. I've gotten, since I think 2014, I've gotten almost 1 million emails. And they've all been classified here. Ones that are useful for protecting yourself are fraud and spam, which I don't bother reporting, and virus. The fraud and the virus I actually try to report to by forwarding them on to some email addresses I have. I Haven't had any reply from them in months, so I hope they're looking at them or putting them in a database. And all other things. You notice I have a prefix, like 1, 2, 3, 4. That's because it's easy to reclassify them, you'll see in the next slide, by putting in one character and it pops up the name from our list. So these are all the buckets that I use. And you can also, the bucket colors are here, and they show in a display down below that's not here. Let's see, I wonder if I can. No, I can't. Okay. And when it comes to my mail, these are the things that get put inside my mail. X text classification, which is virus. And this is the X text classification header here. And this is X classification to fraud. And this is the link which I can use to correct if they got it wrong, if it isn't a virus, or alternatively when it's unclassified and it does a virus. And you can also control different things, the history view, how many days, how many messages per page, and so on. So you can actually control a pop file as to how it appears to you. You can set up magnets, configuration, etc., etc. And here's what it looks at a particular message for me. This is how you teach it, what the thing is. So here, the bucket is unclassified, and you go here, and you choose to reclassify it by putting in the bucket that it should be, which is, for example, virus. I type V, and virus shows up, and I click reclassify, and then it realizes that. You can also set up ignored words in here, so all the common words that appear in HTML and in my email appear here. You can add them, you can edit them. And here's, you can also look up a word in a bucket to see where it actually appears inside the thing and what is the probability it is. And here I looked up Linux. And guess where it appears? It appears most often here, and the probability is about 70% that it's going to be in Linux. And the next highest is computing, and so on. So you can really investigate if you want to control it. But mostly I just set and forget. Wind Patrol is abandonware. But I haven't seen anything else that does anything similar to it. What it does is it alerts changes to startup programs. So you get an alert if something is been added to your startup thing. In this case, it's Aces Switch. And you can choose to accept the change or reject it. And delete something that's in startup, like UMON at 64, you get this alert, and then you can click OK because it's already been deleted. So this is something that I have not seen anywhere else, and so I still use it. I have the install file for historical reasons, and it's a very useful tool. Another useful tool is Wi-Fi Guard. This is a way of keeping tabs on your network. And in fact, although it's called Wi-Fi Guard, it's not just Wi-Fi. It actually keeps tab on everything that's in your network. And in fact, I don't have Wi-Fi enabled on my laptop. I use a hardwire connection. And it will, as you can see here, network adapters, Realtek, PCI, and so on. This is my network ID. Scan this from many devices, rescan every 5 minutes, which I think is the minimum amount. And this is what shows up. And when you have a device on here, you can recognize it by I know. You can put in the name of it, which appears here. It gives the MAC address. You can actually look up the MAC address, and the MAC address is actually used to identify the vendor. So 18D6C7 is always TP-Link. And 244BFE is always ASUS Tech. You can then you will get, if something comes on your network that another device of some sort has snuck in, you can identify it. It will come up with an alert and tell you, and it will rescan the network every 5 minutes. So, and there's another, this is a bonus, auto runs. You can identify strangers here, but you can also identify everything that you have that starts up when you start. And this is, this is everything, but you can actually go to individual tabs here to see all the different things that are sources of stuff that start up when something happens. Start up on logon, start up with Explorer, Internet Explorer, and so on, boot execute, image hijacks, etc., etc. And they're all classified down here. This is logon. And so I have this. This is where it is. This is the registry source. The startup folder is further down, but they're basically they're in different registry entries here. It comes from Microsoft. It's from the sysinternals guys who have created a whole bunch of programs that are very useful for keeping a tab on your computer and especially for investigating problems. And you can also look up to see if there's anything strange that has snuck in. It's a good idea to look over it now and then and eliminate stuff that takes up too much time when you are starting up. It's also a good idea to see if there are any strangers. And you'll notice here, virus total. This shows the this will actually go out and for each of the files, these are the files, it will actually send it off to virus total, which will identify as to how many of their virus detection engines have found a virus with this or a virus being within it or some kind of questionable thing. I have perfect confidence in Wind Patrol, so that 1 out of 73 is just a false negative, a false positive. It'll have that for all of your things. And if it hits more than one or two or three, in fact, if it hits one, look into it. They're not always identified by virus total, especially new ones. So it's a good idea to have to every so often look at auto runs and see what's there. So security layers. There's no single magic bullet. You need action. You need to put in a whole bunch of programs and activities to actually check on things and avoid things. And you need awareness. You need to actually keep your eyes on what programs you're running, what it's accessing, are there any strangers, and so on. And programs that I've identified before will help you with that. Are there any questions?
What I'll do is I can't force an unmute on people, but what I can do is I can do a mute all with the ability to unmute yourself. And that would include you, Tom, so you'll have to unmute yourself again. So all participants can now unmute themselves and go ahead and ask questions. Just going through, we have a bunch of stuff in the chat for sure. We have a few links that people threw in for interesting services, for backup, for password managers and things like that. So if you're interested in that, take a look at the chat. It will be posted on our website later on as well, so you don't have to worry about it if you don't catch it tonight. I actually had a question myself. Is when you're looking at add-ins like uBlock and things like that, do you know if they provide any sort of guidance? Because I think that a lot of, in particular, novices might not understand the implications of blocking certain things. And so I just wonder how good they are at advising, you know, why you should block certain things and what might happen, good and bad, if you go ahead and block that. What's been your experience with most of the add-ins? Tom, you're muted.
Okay, that should be better.
Yep.
These add-ins, uMatrix and uBlock Origin, do not actually, they only advise as to what, and they go from a bunch of lists that are created over the internet. You can't actually you can use those lists that do those things, and they are advisory rather than compulsory. So you don't have to actually turn things on or off according to what they say. Add-ons themselves can be dangerous. They have access to what you're doing online. Now, Firefox has a bunch of add-ons that are I'm not sure what they call them. Let's see. If I can get to the right. Extensions. Oh, they have recommended add-ons. And so you can choose, if you choose recommended add-ons, they're fairly safe. Other add-ons are not necessarily safe. I haven't had a problem in the last, 15 to 20 years or so. I've had a good experience, but I'm pretty careful ordinarily, so that's not a necessarily a recommendation about strange things. But I usually try to choose the ones that have been downloaded a whole bunch of times, and especially the ones that are recommended by Firefox. I don't think that Chrome has the same sort of thing for recommendation thing for its add-ons. But Chrome, they do try to winnow out any bad actors, like they do for their App Store on Android. So buyer beware if it's free.
Yeah, I would guess in that regard, though, one of the things that I always advise people is look at how long something has been around. So if you have some add-in that's been around for years, if they're a bad actor, it probably would have shown up by now. If you have something that is just new in, the last month, I would certainly take a pass on it until other people have played guinea pig on it. So I think that can help a lot. But I think probably my biggest concern on some of these add-ins is that, they say, it'll keep you safe, but they don't give you, what the implications can be that are not necessarily malicious. A good example on that is Holland America Cruise Lines. If you go to their website and you block JavaScript, you get a blank page. They do everything through JavaScript. And so, if you have that enabled in whatever security add into your browser, you go to Holland America and you might not realize that that's why you're getting a blank page. And so you just think, oh, the site's broken or something, and you go on to something else.
That's why uMatrix is really nice, because it lets you specify, which JavaScript you will be allowed, or from what site it's allowed. And so I usually have, for example, Google cookies turned off on just about everything except when I'm running Chrome, and that's in Chrome is where I have my calendar and some emails and some other things like that. So I run with cookies for Google there. But on Firefox and everything else, I have Google turned off. I use about half a dozen browsers. I have uMatrix and uBlock Origin works with them all. And I use it to be able to be more secure. And so I usually run with JavaScript off unless I really need it. I like JavaScript off for third-party sites unless I really need it. So if you go to Holland America, or for that matter, any site, the problem usually occurs not on the site itself, unless it is a malicious site, but for ads and so on that are on it, because people have in the past snuck bad JavaScript into ads, and it goes down often several different layers of malware to be able to escape it being junked by not just by browsers, but by the people who allow the ads in. Usually, I think I would expect that the domains do not allow ads in without checking them first.
One would hope. We have a question from Lillian. Antivirus for Mac users. Do you or anybody else have an opinion on Mac OS, or I guess iOS on phones? So the need for or effectiveness of antivirus for Mac.
I think you do need it, but I don't have any advice on it. You can, if you use, Safari doesn't work with uBlock Origin and or uMatrix. But you can run Firefox on the Mac, for that matter on Linux as well. And the extensions will work on there, so you can run Firefox on the Mac and do that. I'm not sure how safe or unsafe Safari is. I have very little Mac experience.
Okay, a question from Natalie. What's your opinion on two-factor authentication that is using SMS text messages for the authentication code?
It's not very good. SMS is quite untrustworthy these days. The SS7 big machines that run the phone networks have very little, if any, security, and people have easily supported it. So it's better than nothing. Anything is better than nothing. But my suggestion would be to get the authenticator the authenticator app for your phone, and there are a variety of them. Microsoft has one, Google has one. Either one of those will give you a time-limited PIN to enter, and it's a second-factor authentication. I'm sorry I didn't mention it up above, but it also works for websites and so on. When I pay with PayPal, I have an authenticator thing, and it's very easy to set up, especially with your phone, because the website shows you a QR code, and you take a picture of it with your authenticator thing, and automatically sets it up. And from that point on, you can have a whole bunch of authenticator tokens or authenticator pins for each and every website or domain that supports it, and I recommend that. Better, it's better than having any kind of SMS or voice message. But voice message is better than nothing, and SMS is better than nothing.
For the authenticator apps, I have a question on that. Is that you have different ones that are available out there, like from Google and from Microsoft. I presume that any website that wants to use that particular authenticator app, you might have to have multiple authenticator apps on your phone, would you not? Or
you do, well, no, you only have one app, but it has an entry for each. Each of the websites you're accessing.
Okay.
They're probably, I don't know if you can get an authenticator app for example, signing on to Windows. I haven't investigated that at all, but I mean, that would potentially be possible. But you can get the authenticator app has a website, and for each domain, whether it's, you know, PayPal, or if I take a look on my phone, here, I'll show it to you. This is the Google Authenticator app.
It doesn't show like people, your virtual background.
But I have a Google for each. It's actually, it's not only the, it's not only the particular website, it's also your ID on it.
Okay.
So you can.
So you should be able to get away with just a single authenticator app.
Yes, and Microsoft and Google are probably fairly trustworthy.
The problem is, though, Chris, it's as Tom said, the website or whatever has to support it.
Yeah.
And Natalie's just making the point that she doesn't have a choice with certain sites. They send the code, and that's what she has to use for 2FA.
Yeah, and I think Tom's point is a good one, and I think Tristan made the same comment, is it's better than nothing. And so, you know, anything that you layer on is going to increase the resilience of your authentication. So if that's what you've got available to you, go for it. It'll help.
One thing
I'm wondering is, what are the chances that your security is compromised if you're just logging on and they're going to send you a code?
Yeah.
They don't send you a code. You read you type in the code. The code is always there on the authenticator app. There's some kind of algorithm that creates a code. I think it's my guess is that that you don't even have they don't register with Google or anybody else. Something that will, when the authenticator app reads it, will create a code, will create an algorithm that will, using that is unique for the particular domain and the ID you're signing in with. And then that algorithm changes the code every 30 seconds.
Yeah,
and
but I think
I'm thinking of what happens if you're not using an authenticator, but you're just receiving a code by SMS.
Yeah, I think the likelihood of it being compromised at the same time that you're logging on to a particular site is probably on the low side.
It depends if someone is really targeting you. Someone is targeting you because they have, for example, they've gotten into your system and now they want to send a PayPal payment to a particular destination in Bazookistan. They will go to the effort of doing stuff. Then it depends on what their powers are with regard to the SMS. By the way, I should also mention, I also use a FIDO key. This is a FIDO key. You can get them on Avison. YubiKey is the best well-known of them. But those plug into your USB port, and there's a button on them that glows green when it's plugged in. That is which I use with Google and with some other with some sites that actually support them on the web. So that's another factor of authentication. And this one cost me $10. I think but it's not FIDO 2, so I can't use it. For example, with Windows, I think there is one with Windows. You can get fancier ones that work with Bluetooth for your phone, or work with NFC with your phone so that you can use it to authenticate your phone accessing a website. I just have the most basic one that just uses the USB connection.
We have a comment from Greg just saying that he found the free VPN add-ons very suspicious. So if anybody has any comments on negative or positive aspects of that, you could chime in. Trista mentions about DNS provider Quad9 being able to block known malicious sites. That's a really good provider. It was initiated by IBM Security, but it's actually a consortium of about a dozen different companies, and they have terabytes of information on malicious websites and that. And yeah, they can block you from going to a site that is a known bad site. It's free service, commercial or home use, doesn't matter.
Oh, by the way, there's also for that at Quad9, there's now, it's sort of in beta, there's a Quad9 app for Android it works, it actually uses the VPN interface that Google supports, and it will send all your queries for domain names to get the IP address to actually access it. Through the Quad9. Quad9 is run by, I think, IBM and Cloudflare, and they're very secure, and they don't do any logging or anything like that, and I would trust them.
Yeah. Tristan pasted into the chat about all authenticators using the same standard. You can use any one of them, and he put in a Wikipedia link, so thanks very much for that, Tristan. That'll be good to read that. So Natalie says, came across several in-person services requiring forms to be filled in online for things like COVID screening that I can't print or download. Need to fill in online, and it gets sent to them online using their system. I tried getting info on their security protocol and got nowhere. I got pegged as annoying or paranoid. Yeah, that certainly is the approach that some of them can take. But I think if you think about the fact that if you're going to end up sending it to them at some point anyways, the fact that it gets filled out online, is that any worse than sending it to them any other way? Because I would be willing to bet that the information ends up on a system that's accessible over the internet anyways. And so if you're worried about it being compromised by attackers and something like that, I'd be concerned whether they have you fill it out online or send it to them another way. I don't know if anybody else has any other opinions on that. Chime in. I'd be happy to revise my opinion on it.
If you can't print it, you can scan it, drop it into a word processor, and save it as a PDF file.
Yeah. Could do a screen cap of it or something like that, I guess. And B asked, should you delete the SMS codes once you use them? Just off the top of my head, I would say yes, delete them. But they are, generally speaking, time limited. So they will only work for typically a couple of hours before they expire, at most a couple of hours, and so they will expire anyways. But there's no reason to keep them because they are one-time codes. You can't actually reuse them anyways. Tristan says, for the COVID forms, if they have a work phone, use that number. If you have a work phone, use that number. At least then the spam calls go there. That's a thought. Tom mentions that the SMS codes do expire. So, but they are useless. So, I mean, there's no reason to keep them, and so forth. So I think that's all the questions I've seen in the chat. If you've had something else that hasn't been answered, chime in again. I'm sorry if I missed something. Natalie says, it just astounds me how many places don't care about security, and some of the data is sensitive health-related stuff. I agree, and I think it was Tristan that mentioned he was astounded by the fact that Canadian banks, you know, still don't insist on two-factor authentication, and I'm astounded as well. I mean, to me, that's unconscionable that they don't take security more seriously, that they would actually require two-factor authentication. Could cut out so much fraud. Those phishing emails that say, you know, here, there's something wrong with your account, log in here and fix the problem, and you get taken to the attacker's website. My dad fell for it and had about $800 removed from his Scotiabank account. Scotiabank was, they refunded the money, but we all pay for this. So,
I complained to my bank. They only... their password is only 11 characters. And I complained, that's way too small. Really, I mean, you should allow unlimited length passwords, is what I told them. And I talked to the guy at their annual meeting who was in charge of all this, and he said, well, yeah, they are short mainly so people can remember them and get fewer calls complaining about lost passwords, but also we check on other things like what IP are you doing from and where is this located and how reasonable is this. And so there are other checks. Like I said before, they use there are other checks that banks do to make sure that the person logging on is reasonable. But, of course, that means if your computer is taken over, it passes those checks.
That's true.
So don't get your computer taken over.
All right. Yeah. Natalie had a comment. RBC has security questions as part of the login. Security questions can be a tricky double-edged sword because often, you know, if they're ones that you set up the answer for and they ask you, you know, what's your favorite food, you know, is that something that other people on the internet could easily research and find out that, oh, you really like pizza, and that's probably your correct answer. What I suggest that people do is either of two things, either answer totally false. So, you know, favorite food would be Toronto, you know, or something like that, just totally nonsense answer, and then record that as part of your password keeper. Or always answer correctly because that's easy for you to remember, but then always add a secret word to every question. So, you know, if your secret word is pen, you know, favorite food might be pen pizza or something like that. So although people be able to research and find out that they your favorite food is pizza, they wouldn't know that you've prepended it with the word pen or something like that. That's another approach that you can take. Joss has a thing, a little curious. Do you think it would be an idea to do a short survey asking who has been a malware victim and if possible, provide a little explanation on how? We'll look for that to do in a Q&A, Joss. It's not super fast and easy to set it up, but that's a good idea. We could do that as part of the Q&A.
There was a comment earlier to Tom's thoughts that you should always have the original installation software. Stefan notes that you also need to back up the license keys used to unlock the software in case you need to reinstall it.
Good point. A lot of times you can contact the company and get their license key again, but there's no guarantee that would be the case. If you buy something at a CD at a store in particular, and it has the license key as part of the packaging, well, the vendor doesn't have any way of matching up you as a person with a particular license key necessarily, so that's a really good point.
You could print that on the CD if it's on a CD. If it's a file, if you've loaded it on your computer and you're saving it there, you can just put it in the name. You names are 256 characters in Windows, and I often put other stuff in there like the date of the file if it's a new release. I put in other stuff. If it's a PDF, I often put in the title of the PDF in at the end. I usually put it in parentheses so that it's clear that one of the I keep the old name at the front just to see, mainly to identify duplicates. But I put it all into the name, and there it is, and it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah, I put it all into my password keeper. So all my software that's licensed software, it has an entry in there. So it has their website and things like that. I also put in the purchase date of the software, the license keys, where I can download the software from and everything like that. All goes into my password keeper. And so I have one-stop shopping for all of that sort of information. I find it very, very handy. Natalie has a comment, Air Miles has a 4-digit password. That's pretty sad. Tristan says the security questions are not great. Most can be figured out by going on Facebook. I agree. And that's why I think if you either answer with nonsense answers, record the answers in your password keeper, or prepend or append some other word to the correct answer.
Well, Tom says, Facebook account.
Yeah, they can still find you there, Alan. So yeah, Tom says put in random garbage. OpenDNS, he mentions, is an alternative to Quad9. There's more control. OpenDNS actually has two DNS services that you can use. One is just a general security thing. Another one, which you have to be able to create a free account for, it allows you to do blocking based on about 50 different categories. So it's really kind of cool that you can be very granular in that. Tristan says, if you're really ambitious, you can set up your own home enterprise level firewall using something like OpenSense or PFSense. Yeah, if you, as you say, if you're really ambitious, Tom says 25 domains for free. So, block categories and 25 domains for free. Mavo has, any opinion on Mozilla's VPN? Tom, do you, have you ever used Mozilla's VPN?
No, I just saw it recently. I think it's new within the last few months.
Yeah.
And it's something like 99 cents a month. I have not tried to use it or looked into it particularly.
If anybody else has experience with Mozilla's VPN, by all means, chime in. One semi-VPN, it's not really a VPN, it's for the browser only, is Opera. And so you can turn on this VPN type feature within Opera, and it'll send all your browser traffic through, you know, a proxy, and you don't have very much control about where it comes out. But I have had success where something that was geo-blocked, such as something on Comedy Central or something like that, they post something on YouTube, you go to view it and it says, oh, sorry, we don't show it for your location. And if I go through Opera, quite often, it'll end up that it'll show it quite fine. So that's a free option that is available for people. There is also, I've used TunnelBear, which is out of Toronto, I believe. It's a Canadian company anyways. And they, will give you certain amount free. I think it's 500 megabytes.
Yeah,
500 megabytes a month for free, and then if you want more than that, you can pay for their service. And they have locations around the world that you can choose where your traffic will go. And it's a true VPN. It's not just the browser. It'll be all your traffic. Lillian asks, would a browser like DuckDuckGo be a help? Tom, do you have an opinion on that? Oh, Tom is gone. His elephants are sitting in his place. Anybody else have an opinion on using DuckDuckGo from a security point of view, I presume?
I use it all the time. I've never had an issue, but it's a search engine.
Yeah, it really is just not tracking your searches is really what it's giving you. On that, as opposed to really, it's more a privacy thing than a security thing, I think. And what about Kaspersky's VPN that comes with their software? So many opinions about the company and Russian Link. Yeah. Anybody, care to chime in on the idea of Kaspersky being out of Russia, whether it's actually controlled by the Kremlin or not? I don't know. My opinion on VPNs is that they can be great if you're in a public Wi-Fi hotspot so that all your traffic is encrypted end to end. If you don't use a VPN, your traffic between you and the Wi-Fi hotspot router is not necessarily encrypted. Now, almost all browser sessions now seem to be encrypted. You can't use a Google service without it being HTTPS, which means it's encrypted end-to-end. And certainly a lot of your traffic is going to be encrypted anyways. So my thought on VPN has always been that it's great for geo-blocking, getting around geo-blocking. So you can have it that your traffic appears to be coming from France or the United States or Japan or whatever you choose with your VPN provider. But the encryption end of VPNs, I don't know. I personally don't think that it's as big a deal. If anybody wants to chime in and tell me that I'm out to lunch on that, please do so. Stu says on Android, DDG is a browser as well as a search engine. And Tom says you can make your own VPN using your computer when you're away. That's possible, so that all your traffic would end up looking like it's coming from your computer as opposed to where you happen to be on the road. Not the simplest thing to set up, I don't think, but it definitely can be done. And B has a question if anybody has an opinion on Bitdefender VPN. So if anybody has an opinion on that, please chime in. Tristan says VPN is only for security if both ends are under your control. And that's actually a good point with VPNs too, is that you have to trust the VPN provider because all your traffic is going through the VPN provider. And so, you know, how do you validate that you can really trust your VPN provider?
Well, it depends on the same thing is true for for your ISP. True. All your traffic is going going through them as well.
That's true.
And if the traffic is encrypted with HTTPS or TLS or SFTP or then I think it's pretty safe. It depends. I mean, there are exceptions and ways around and stuff like that. In particular, the HTTPS depends on, and for that matter, TLS in general, depends on certificates being okay. And in some places, those are not. They're provided by the government, so the government can see everything in it. And so it's this man-in-the-middle attack where it gets sent up to the government or whoever's in the middle. They decrypt it and can look at it, and then they re-encrypt it and send it off to the original person, to the original destination if they so choose, and same thing in reverse. So it's mostly okay, but there's a lot of trust on the internet, and sometimes it's well placed, sometimes it's not well placed, and sometimes even things just disappear.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to the idea, I guess, at some point you just have to trust people, period. Otherwise, you may as well turn off your computer, right? I mean, you have to believe that Microsoft is not going to, sell all of the data on your computer to a third party, because as the builder of Windows, they could do it if they so chose to do so. You know, you do have to have a certain amount of trust at some point or another. Tom did put in the chat that Bitdefender VPN is okay, and Stu has Proton VPN is one of the few that is not based on a 14 eyes country. So I didn't know there was a 14 eyes country. So I mean, again, this is whether you are going to trust or not. Tristan says it's perhaps sad commentary on society, but the best security is trusting no person or organization. I once heard a comment that the only truly safe, trustworthy computer is encased in concrete and dropped in the middle of the ocean, and even then he wasn't exactly sure. IT security is thus moving to new forms called zero trust. And I back when I was working at NRCan, we had in Gartner at one point, and they were talking about a model that of, you know, setting up our desktop computers that, was really rather open, letting them do whatever they wanted. And I said, well, you know, if you do that, you can't trust these computers anymore. He says, well, yeah, exactly. And so you have to treat them all as completely untrustworthy devices. And, well, there's big implications in doing things like that. What else? We got some things coming in. John Fleming says Norton 360 includes VPN that is from SurfEasy, an Ontario company. Interesting to know. So people who use Norton 360, I presume that that's not an added cost to use their VPN. So that is an option if you like using a VPN. VPNs can slow down your browsing as well, potentially, because all your traffic has to go through that VPN server, and if it's at all congested, your traffic is going to be in amongst the congestion. Natalie says, if downloading an app that wants access to media files, camera, contacts, etc., and then block that access, is there an issue? Usually the app will stop working. You know, if you, it needs, well, ideally, it only asks for permissions of things it needs to operate correctly. There are some apps that just go and say, well, it's easiest for us to just request all permissions, and then we know our app will work. In that case, if it is that, you potentially could block access to things that you think that app really has no business, you know, accessing. But the potential certainly is that the app is going to stop working. I have heard of flashlight apps that many years ago, but a flashlight app that needed access to everything. And I think, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. I don't know why that would be the case. Timothy says, I have McAfee VPN. The Ontario Lottery Corp will not allow you to use VPN as they need to know if you order tickets from within the province. Now, that would be if they can detect that it's a VPN. Now, they probably have a very extensive list of IP addresses that are used by VPN providers, but there is a chance you'd be able to get away with it if they are not blocking that particular VPN provider that you're using. But that's an interesting thing, and I guess anybody could potentially block VPN access, and anybody who's trying to do geo-blocking, they could actually be more active at it and try to block anything coming in on a VPN connection. Leon asks, how about NordVPN? So if anybody has an answer on that. China, Russia don't like VPNs. That's true, and there are some countries where it's illegal. And so I highly recommend that anybody who's traveling, make sure that you verify before you go to that country with a VPN installed on your computer, because you have the potential of getting arrested.
Yeah, Buzz Walker here. The Avast security suite, if you get the Avast Ultimate security suite, it comes with what they class as a secure browser, and it also comes with their own VPN. The VPN is fairly reasonable, and I've used the browser a few times, and it's not too bad. But because it all comes from the security company, you can have a little bit more trust than you can if you piece together everything from different places.
Yeah. Good point.
If you use Google as a browser, you can be guaranteed they're tracking everything you're doing. So, And I've used the NordVPN before I got the Avast Ultimate Suite, but you get the Avast VPN for free as part of the suite. I stopped using the NordVPN because you had to pay for it.
Right. Yeah, Tom mentions you could use Tor, the Onion router. It basically is like a VPN in the sense that for all your traffic goes through the Tor infrastructure. I've never used it. Maybe other people have different opinions. I've heard that it can slow down your browsing quite a bit if you're using Tor. If anybody knows that is out-of-date information, by all means, pop in an answer on that. And Tom also points out that the Windows Firewall Control is a very nice program to find programs that are trying to access the internet. And that to me is like really, really important, is if you get malicious software running on your computer, if you have something that will pop up and say, hey, you've got some new program that is trying to access the internet, do you want to allow it or not? That's really, really nice security add-on. So again, it's all about layers. And so everything you can get that will not prevent you from using your computer, but provide you with some additional security is a great thing for sure. And Tom does note that Tor is very slow, plus some nation states monitor the nodes. And I've heard that some entrance pupils for Tor are actually run by the CIA and things like that, and NSA. And so you're not necessarily gaining anonymity necessarily. Again, I'm at the point where I think I've covered off all the questions. If anybody had a question that was not answered, by all means, jump in. Again, you can unmute yourself if you want to just ask audibly or throw it into the chat window.
Yeah. About you were talking about performance decrease with some of the VPNs in terms of speed, but I also noticed like using Opera VPN when trying to watch something on PBS, that the video quality was lower. So.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that was do you think that was scaled back because it noticed that the traffic was slow? Or
that was my guess, but it's okay. Just a guess. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, security is always trade-offs, right? It's if you get severe enough, you get an unusable, unworkable computer, and if it's not strong enough, you get a compromised computer and compromised privacy and everything like that. It's all a balancing act, I guess. And again, Tom put in a suggestion that the main VPN use is to watch a video in foreign lands. And I think that is the case, that a lot of it's used to get around geo-blocking. Okay. Yeah, due to copyright, Tom says. So, yeah, some content creators will release content, but for a specific geographic location, and so they don't want it seen in other ones for whatever reason. They've decided that they'll monetize differently or whatever. So, yeah, you're getting around copyright limitations usually. That's a big thing with things like Netflix, and you can use a VPN. My understanding is Netflix still doesn't really care. So they don't block VPN access, but if you want all of the U.S. content on Netflix, which is different than Canadian content, but the only way you can do it is going through a VPN.
But there are a lot of videos available within Canada on the networks, on CTV and Global and so on, as well as TVO. I found the networks to have a fairly high quality signal. TVO seems to buy low resolution documentaries. You can also eliminate with an ad blocker such as U-Matrix. You can also eliminate all of the ads on Global and CTV and still see the video. It takes a little tuning of your U-Matrix at the start, but it works.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Any final questions? Oh, Natalie just said, as an aside, my insurance company offers identity theft coverage, inexpensive, to help with the aftermath. If you can get coverage, it can often, I guess, be helpful if you happen to be targeted and they manage to compromise your identity. Kind of nice to be able to have a bit of help cleaning up the mess. I know one person who was going through an identity theft problem that 2 years later she was still dealing with issues caused by it, and the Ottawa police, they said they knew who it was, but they wouldn't tell her for whatever reason. I don't know. She could never find out why they wouldn't divulge who it was that was responsible. And it took her after 2 years, she was still dealing with it. So kind of strange. Okay, I think then we are coming up on 9 o'clock. So I think unless there's last questions or comments or anything like that, I think that we'll go ahead and close out the session for tonight. So Tom, thanks very much. That was really, really good overview of like a lot of the things that you can do with layering your security. And every little bit helps. So thanks very much for your presentation. We're getting a lot of kudos coming in. Alan mentions Q&A next week will be December 15th. So send in your questions and shares and to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. We have a couple of things already lined up, but we need more for sure. So lots of thanks and kudos. Great presentation. Good presentation. That was great, Tom. So forth. So I'll be getting Tom's deck, and so we'll be getting that up onto the website in the past presentations area over the next couple of days, I would say, along with contents of the chat, which is going to be a huge chat when file this time around. We have lots of great information in the chat, and the audio will all be going up within the next couple of days. So again, thank you very much, Tom. Great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nice job, Tom. Good night.